Hey, Collabbers. I'm Ben Leroy.
And I'm Jason Buckles.
Welcome to Collabracast. How you doing, Jay?
I'm doing well. How about you?
I'm doing all right. Spring is trying to show up here, and it is sometimes sunny, sometimes cloudy, definitely windy. In Wisconsin, we've got this period right now where it's like tomorrow there might be a tornado, and in 2 days there'll be a blizzard. And that's kind of hard to adjust for. And it's also demoralizing on occasion when you're waiting for spring to show up and then the late spring blizzard hits. It sucks. Just be honest. My upper Midwest people know what I'm talking about. But other than that, it's good. How about you? How's the Bay Area treating you here in mid-April?
We haven't maybe explicitly covered the fact that you're in Madison, Wisconsin, and I am in now Richmond, California. Very different microclimates, yes. Macroclimates, all the scales of climates are very different. Although I've spent a lot of time in Cincinnati, so I am not unfamiliar with the upper Midwest.
You've spent time in the 513. What were you doing in the 513?
My dad hails from the 513. In fact, I was born in Oxford, Ohio, while my dad was at Oxford University. Miami University. It's a university there that's named after another famous place.
It's Miami. Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. So he was at Miami University. And that's where I got born. And I was there. I lived there all of 9 months. So I cannot claim to be a California native. I am, in fact, an Ohio native, but moved to Santa Rosa, California at the tender age of 9 months old and have been here pretty much since. But out here, we had a day that was 92 degrees last week.
Yeah.
Yesterday, the high, I think, was like 51. So
you know what it's like when it's just those radical swings that are just, they're hard on the system.
Yeah. And it was nice here because last week happened to coincide with my kid's spring break. So I think the schools were kind of split between spring breaks this week and spring breaks last week. So we had the last week one. So we were out at the beach on a 80 plus degree day for our spring break, which, you know, can't complain about that.
Are people remembering to wear their sunscreen when they're at the beach?
They are.
Okay.
We're big into
that. Your old pal Ben is a walking PSA for the sunscreen. For listeners who don't know, I had a little cancer on my face. I had a little melanoma and they had to melon ball a sizable portion of my face and it was uncomfortable. So now I am a full-on evangelist for the SPF 120. Like, get it on there good. You don't want to go through what I went through.
I got a big floppy hat.
I've got the big floppy hat. I've got the sunglasses. I've got the whole thing. I've got the long sleeve shirts, even when it's 100 degrees out. I will put a link to the photo on the podcast notes for this episode where you can see post-surgery what sort of work they did on my face. And if you're a little squeamish, I probably wouldn't click on that link, but if you're at least intrigued, maybe give it a look
I'm both squeamish and intrigued, so I went for it. I think this is a good explanation though, because I think that, you know, you've got that little bit of discoloration there that could easily be misinterpreted as the post laser tattoo removal of a jailhouse teardrop tattoo.
Yeah, nope.
So I just need to clarify that.
I've been given a whole load of suggestions about how to cool it up a little bit, you know, knife fight, bar fight, like all kinds of stuff that I could use as an explanation for it. But nope, it was just me being a dumbass and ignoring science and doctors and being like, I don't need sunscreen. And
I live in Wisconsin.
Well, yeah, like what about it? And I'm reasonably certain that this appeared around the 2012-2013 era is when I got a sunspot, when I got a nice little sunspot right there. And it was, I was spending a lot of time on the beach in Maui. And so I think that's when it started. Went to the dermatologist at that point, a little afterwards. Dermatologist like, it's fine, but like, we'll just keep an eye on it. No pun intended. And then I went to see the dermatologist many years later in 2019. And she was like, yeah, I think it's still fine, but we should do a biopsy. And I was like, well, what is that going to entail? And she said, well, I'm going to have to cut it, get a scrape there. And I was so concerned with the fact that I had a dentist appointment with a new dentist later on that day, and I didn't want to go in with a bleeding face, that I was like, no, I'm not going to do the biopsy. And then the dermatologist was like, okay, but you really should soon. And the quickest they could get me back in for a biopsy was like 4 months later. And I went in, she's like, I still don't think it's a big deal, and I'll probably just put a note in your chart that everything is fine. But then she called like 2 or 3 days later and was like, oh, well, it turns out actually you've got melanoma, and you definitely want to have that taken care of. And so my vanity of going to the dentist and not wanting to show up with the like blood coming out of my face to meet a new dentist also created part of the problem. So sunscreen and get over yourself are the two things. Like, check your ego in at the door. Take care of yourself.
Good messages.
Good messages indeed.
Good messages. Back
to speaking of messages, let's talk about the query process, because, and I can actually say that this one is a little bit more artful than last week's segue. Messaging is an important part of the publishing and query process. I figured that we can talk about this from a couple of different ways. You're currently working with an agent, so you had to go out on the process and find somebody. And I read a lot of query letters to this day. So I think we can probably both offer a little bit of advice and information. I would encourage people that if we do not cover what you're looking for, send us a question, info@collaboris.org, and we can address it on a subsequent episode of the podcast. But
I have here's an experience that I might not have ever told you about.
Okay.
Coming out of my MFA program, I got hired as an intern for an agent here in Tiburon. She had this little cabin, basically, that she uses as an office. It had a couple of desks where she and her assistant worked, and then it had a couch in the back. And it was essentially the size of a single bedroom, so a little one-bedroom cabin. And it was a beautiful space. It was lined with books, and then there were two desks. And then all around the entire perimeter of this room were thigh-high stacks of submissions. And it was my job to go through, and I mean all around the entire perimeter. So picture a thigh-high stack of, and they weren't even full manuscripts. They were queries and maybe 50 pages plus queries. And just multiply that stack by several dozen until the entire room is long. There was just enough room between these stacks to get to the coffee maker. So I would go in and make myself coffee and sit on a couch and read sometimes hundreds of queries in a day. And then I had a form letter that I would try to at least say a few constructive things on. And then occasionally I would pass her things. But yeah, that was my, I still have a file somewhere of the best/worst ones. I wish I knew where that was. I know it's around somewhere.
I also have a folder full of some of the more noteworthy, I was going to say best queries that I received over the years, but that's
noteworthy
not
is a noteworthy much better adjective.
Yeah. They're was the same kind of thing in our office. Now, of course, people wouldn't have that kind of thing because you're submitting things electronically. But yeah, for a while, I mean, you would get big envelopes stuffed full with manuscripts or excerpts, and there would be a lot of paper floating around. There was, and you could see it all, like people writing their queries in Comic Sans, writing in 30-point font. One of the more apocryphal
handwritten ones from jail. I had several.
For sure.
On the San Quentin stationery.
Yeah, for sure. That is definitely a thing. There was one query that I got where this was back in the Bleak House days. We were publishing crime and what we called dark literary fiction. And I was sitting down to lunch and going through the mail, and there was a big yellow envelope, and it had a bulge in the middle of it. And I opened it and I took out the pages, and in the letter itself, it said something like, "I've been following the music that you listen to and the aesthetic of the company, basically. And I've included something else as a present. Enjoy." So I'm like, well, what's that? And so like, there's this just clump of paper towel in the middle of the envelope. And I'm like, what is this? And I'm sitting down to eat, I'm eating, and I unwrap the paper towel, and it's a raccoon skull. Just dude sent along a raccoon skull and was like, yeah, like this is going to be my magic ticket for getting into the publishing world. And I really wasn't quite sure what to make of the fact that somebody had sent me a raccoon skull. It ended up being kind of a hood ornament for my computer. I put it up there, but as just a general rule, and we can get into this a little bit more, I would advise against sending gifts and presents as part of your query letter packages. There, people would used to send like cookies, which cool, I love cookies, but I don't know you. And I'm not sure that I'm going to eat cookies from a stranger. I, even as a grown up, I knew enough to like avoid that situation. So one of the things that I would love to talk about is, do you remember things that were close to automatic disqualifiers if you came across them in a query letter?
So before we get into all this, Ben, what is a query? What are we talking about? What's a query letter?
We're talking about the initial communication between a writer and an agent, or a writer and a publisher. What you are doing is introducing yourself and your work. And the goal is that the agent or the publisher is going to request part or all of your book to evaluate it. And if it's an agent, your hope, the end goal, is that they will offer representation to you. If it's a publisher, you're hoping that they'll acquire it for publishing. On our website, I do a couple of query letter reviews, and it's a continuing feature of Collaborist, where I am reading real-time query letters and talking about what material should be in there and making sure that it is what material shouldn't be in there and warning people against it. So it's just, in a nutshell, it's your initial communication with an agent or a publisher, and it should answer a couple of questions. What is your book? What genre is it? What is its title? How long is it? What are your relevant writing credentials, if you have any? And
this is in all of about a page long. So this is of everything you ever write as a writer, this is probably the place to put the most care per word into it.
Absolutely.
This is something that, this is a very hardworking 3 to 4 paragraphs, if that, 2 to 3 paragraphs maybe.
And it's important to remember too, that the people who are reading it, in many cases, are going to be junior staff members. They're going to be assistants. They're going to be people who are working their way up the publishing ladder. I'm talking about now, if you've got an agency that's fairly large or a publishing company that's fairly large, there are also times like what I was just talking about where I was running a small press and I was part of the people who was reading the query letter. So the main decision maker is in charge. But what you're trying to do is whoever becomes a champion of your work, you're trying to give them the information and the enthusiasm to tell somebody higher up the chain that here's something that's worth acquiring and putting our resources into, or representing and putting our resources into.
Right. There's a whole chain of command, and you're looking to put together such an impressive letter that it's going to carry you on all the way up to the people who actually make the decisions and write the checks.
And it's important to know that there are a lot of ways, like Jason was talking about, how important it is to, on a per word basis, how important words are in a query letter. And there are a lot of simple mistakes that I have seen people make and that I'm sure Jason has seen people make. So before we even go into anything else, can you tell me things that you came across when you were reading the submission pile, sometimes referred to as the slush pile, sometimes referred to as the query pile? Can you tell me things that you ran into that were close to an automatic no or a no right away?
Yeah, I think, and this gets into pet peeve territory also, but somebody who doesn't approach the process with humility and humbleness. Somebody who, you know, sometimes you get one where it's like, it's your lucky day. Prepare yourself. You are about to be the recipient of the most wondrous idea ever in the history of mankind. I didn't find that to be too, you know, those authors, they tend to be kind of biased towards themselves.
Yeah,
believe it or not, they're not really making that assessment objectively.
A related component to that always drives me crazy is when people slag other writers as part of their query. Like, I don't understand why John Grisham has sold 700 billion books. I'm twice the writer, and I too will be a New York Times bestselling author. It's like, you have no concept of anything if that is your way of doing it. People who would guarantee that they were going to be a bestseller, like, not going to happen. People who would guarantee that they were going to get reviewed in the New York Times, or they had a cousin's neighbor's friend who worked on the Oprah show and that Oprah was going to bring them on as a guest. Like, people like that, to me, I'd say, okay, you're detached from the reality of what's going on here. And if you're detached at this point, before the boat is even moving, I don't know what sort of icebergs lie ahead, but I'm sure they are numerous.
That's a good point. And I think that your mention about disparaging other authors or their work is the same can be said for that competitive title section of the proposal too. I always tell authors that they should write about other authors and other books as if that author or their agent is going to be actually reading it themselves. So there are definitely ways to differentiate your work from other authors. And you do that by saying, this writer is fantastic and appeals to readers because of this, this, and this. Mine does a similar thing, but it also does this other thing, or it does this with a slightly different approach that will appeal to a slightly different category of readers. Another thing that is a definite red flag is somebody who feels that their work is so transcendent as to defy genre. Like, oh, you can't say, this could be anything. It could be this or that. It could work anywhere. Or they talk about their market being the equivalent to the number of English speakers in the entire world.
Which also increases as soon as someone's able to sell all the translations, because their message is universal and it doesn't, just give it language and it'll resonate with people.
Right. So to take those one at a time, in terms of genre, you've never walked into a bookstore and seen a section of genre bending books that transcend categorization. That's not how the industry works. Bookshelves have labels and they have genres, and it sure, you can take a step back and say that it's artificially categorical, but if you want to publish something that defies genre and transcends the whole industry, then you got to kind of go do that yourself, because that's, you can't do that from within the industry.
Yeah, it works the way it works. It's got the ground rules that it's got. The sales team, the marketing team, the reviewers, the media, all of those people are looking for identifiers like genre. And so when you show up and you're like, I'm functioning in a genreless void where only I dwell with my magic pencil, no one's going to take you seriously. It's right. Just, it's not going to happen.
Yeah. You don't get a marketing team that's going to be, oh, okay, well, we know exactly what to do
right.
with that then. Sure.
Question marks. Yeah. I love selling question marks into an uncertain market. Yeah. Let's do it.
Sure. Let's put up thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to back you in that and have no vision of what to do with it.
One thing that I wanted to just jump in, because it's, I think, like five episodes in a row, I was trying to figure out where to work this in. But if you are querying an agency or a publisher, I have good reason to suspect that you know or are able to find the legitimate names of the people who are there. In 2022, right? That's what year it is? Time is a fleeting, missing thing. Sending things to Dear Sirs, that's not going to cut it.
To whom it may concern.
Yeah, but even like to whom it may concern is bad enough. But like, I seriously still open query letters that are addressed to Dear Sirs. And I know that a lot of the people who I work with who are also reading query letters are not responding to Sir. And it's off-putting. And, you know, this is something that gets said a lot. And it's discouraging. I'm not going to tell you it's not. But agents and publishers are looking for a reason to say no, because of exactly what Jason was talking about earlier. There is an immense volume of stuff to sift through. And if you got paid just by reading submissions and query letters, maybe you would take your time and you would have more patience for things. But because that's not actually what brings in money for an agency or a publishing house, book sales are, then giving people an out to be like, well, I'm not going to read this because this was just lazy research, or this isn't, you're not talking to me, so I'm not going to do that. The other thing that bothers me is that people write to a publisher and say, I'm looking for representation for my novel. An agent represents you. A publisher publishes you. If you're writing to a publisher and saying you're looking for representation, you fundamentally misunderstand what's going on. And again, if I'm looking for a reason to not read more, to consider further, me feeling like you don't understand how publishing works or how the process works when there's a lot of material available, it's something where if I'm feeling fussy, and I feel fussy occasionally, if I'm feeling fussy and I open up the query letter pile and I see that, it's like, okay, if you're looking for representation for your novel, you're not going to find it here because this is a publishing house and not an agency. So you should go find an agent to represent you. And then maybe that agent will come back to me later on and say, I'd like to submit this book for your consideration. And I'm not saying any of this. This is an important thing. I'm not saying any of this because I believe that agents or publishers have any business playing aloof gatekeepers. I hate it. I hate that publishers and agents play aloof gatekeepers. I hate it when they do it on social media. I hate it when they do it in interviews and are smug. I don't believe in kicking down I believe in reaching a hand to help people up whenever I can, but you gotta make sure that you don't make mistakes that make it easy to dismiss things.
I don't think that's a case of fussiness. I think it's just, it's an overwhelming, it's a huge filter. It's an overwhelming filtration process. And like I said, there were thigh-high stacks and stacks, you know, dozens of thigh-high stacks. And of all of those, I think I only passed along maybe half a dozen to the agent herself. And it's just, it's aloof and smug is one thing, but there is a statistical reality to it, that there are only so many contracts to go around. And there are, you know, for every one book deal, there are 1,000 people clamoring to get it. So you have to be 1 in 1,000. And if you're addressing it to the wrong person, you're not 1 in 1,000. If you're revealing in a fundamental lack of an understanding about who you're writing to or what they do or what the process is, or if it seems really generic, then they're looking for perfection. They're looking for the diamond in the rough. And so, your job as you're writing one of these is to take away every possible reason that someone can say no to it, and then cross your fingers and your toes.
we're recording this episode and it is not even out in the public. And yet I know without any doubt that a million ears have sort of perked up in the last few minutes for people to say, well, I self-publish, and I self-publish because of all of the odds that you're talking about, the process that you're talking about. I don't want to jump through all of these hoops. I don't want to do all these things. And to you, person who is self-publishing, totally legit thing. I acknowledge that. We're talking right now to the people who are wanting to be a part of this particular process and trying to stop people from making mistakes. So I get it.
There is a type of author who is really better off. I spoke to somebody, I think last week or the week before, and she had a huge social media following. She had pre-sales of a book that she hadn't even published yet. It was a short book. It was a length that the traditional publishing industry was not really going to know what to do with. And I said, I think you're better off. Like if you try to take this out to a traditional publisher and someone falls in love with it, they're going to make all kinds of changes to it that you don't want them to do. And then they're going to charge you a whole bunch of money for the privilege of allowing them to come in and screw up your book. So there are, like you said, not only legit, but there are many good reasons to pursue that.
And in the interest of clarification, when Jason says charge you to do that, he means that they will be taking a lion's share of the revenue, not that they will actually be billing you to edit your work, et cetera, but that your royalties will not be nearly as significant as your money received on a per copy basis if you choose to self-publish.
Right. Thanks for that clarification.
Just as a quick thing, because any publisher who is upfront charging you money is a publisher for you to walk away from.
Or an agent. Someone says, yeah, give me money and then I'll sell your book. That's not how it works. No, that is a scam. That's not how it works. There are, however, you mentioned writing a query to a publisher, requesting representation. There are a handful of publishers out there, kind of smaller independent publishers, who do accept direct submissions, unagented submissions. So you don't have to go through the agent process. If you've got your sights set on one of the big publishers, if like Random House or Harper or Penguin, one of those guys, then you are going to need to go through the agent process. But there is a whole slew of smaller independent publishers who put out really high quality work, who are happy to receive queries or book proposals directly from authors.
Today isn't the day, but in a future episode, we should go over how to evaluate an independent publishing house. Because like Jason said, there are a lot that are doing really phenomenal work, not just adding to the canon of great literary fiction, but there are people pushing boundaries, style. These are the people who, if you've got the genreless floating words book, you might have some success with an independent publishing house that's trying to do something different. Your results with that might not be the same as if you publish something more traditional with a larger house. But future episode, I think we should definitely cover that, because technology has made it so that anyone can start a publishing company now. And they're not all created equal. And I say that as somebody who built two publishing companies that were both later sold to larger media companies. So I feel like I have walked the walk here, and that I have walked alongside and walked through a lot of people all over the place as far as quality. I have my heroes of people that I modeled our companies after. And then I've also see the people where I'm like, you have no business calling yourself a publisher, and all you are going to do is just set people up for disappointment and broken hearts. And we should be able to say, this is not how things are done.
So now that we've terrified people about writing query letters, what should actually go in there? What's the right way to do it?
Okay. For me, I want to see the title. I want to see the word count, and I want to know that the word count is in line with what the market expectations are for that genre. I want to see the genre mentioned, and I want to see a very brief summary of what happens in the book. Like Jason said, this whole letter is only 3 or 4 paragraphs, so you're not giving me a detailed thing. You're just giving me enough so that I have an idea of what's going on. I'm intrigued. And then the writer's background. And it's important to point out here that a lot of people get to the writer's relevant writing life and get nervous or feel inadequate because maybe they don't have credits, or maybe the credits they have are from smaller places. All of that's okay. No one's expecting you to be querying and being like, well, I want 8 Pulitzers and now I've got a different project and I want to try something else. Like it's okay to be underpublished, not published previously. And I don't even just mean novels. I mean short stories, et cetera. And I should mention that if you have published with the small press and a book didn't do well by any measure, critically or commercially, or if you self-publish, same thing, that is a relevant detail, and it is one that may work against you in some ways, because there is a line of thinking in the publishing industry that if an author puts out a book and it doesn't do well, then the market has decided about what that author's viability is, which is of course grossly oversimplified thinking, and yet it exists and is that way. So there's a possibility that if you have done those things, that you might want to be open to writing under a pseudonym, because publishing industry thinks that people are easily fooled by changes in names. But what's important is that you let people know, because I've definitely been involved with authors who, I really love this book, I really want to acquire it. And one of the things that a publisher gets excited about is when something is a debut novel, they have the opportunity to tell media and booksellers and librarians, you're an unknown quantity. So people can be excited about that. And if you've already put out books, then it's not a debut. And so a lot of your new stuff even if you're reaching for a bigger audience now, you can't, you're not eligible for reviews based on the fact that you're a debut novelist. And so you go into the pile of just plain old books, not by debut authors. And it's harder to get attention there. And so again, one of the workarounds that people have cleverly come up with is using pseudonyms, but be honest and forthright in that stuff. And I guess I could make an argument for you don't have to put it in your query letter that you've done these things before, but if someone does make an offer of representation or does say that they want to publish your book, you need to be forthcoming with that.
I think you mentioned something interesting there too, where, you know, some people might have a sense that not having had a publishing history is going to be a mark against them. But it's oftentimes not. I mean, that isn't something, obviously, if somebody says, oh yeah, I published this or that, and it's, you know, did well, that's going to, it demonstrates a certain level of experience, but the quality of the writing of the letter itself is really important. And a lack of experience isn't really a mark against you. Just put that letter together and say who you are and let the work speak for itself. Assuming, of course, you've put the work into the work, but that's a different podcast or all of the rest of the podcasts.
It is, but it's also a really good point is like, don't query until you're ready to query, because people will say my 80,000 word novel, and then an agent will say, cool, send it to me. And you're like, I just have to finish the last half of it. And like, that's a blown opportunity. Or my 80,000 word novel. And it's like, well, how many times has it been edited and revised and looked at and fixed? Oh, no, this is a first draft. Like, that's also not the time to query. You need to have the best manuscript that you can bring forward when you're querying it.
You got one shot. You've got, if somebody asks for your first 50 pages or the whole manuscript or whatever, you're going to have one shot and you got to be ready right then. And that could be later in the day after you send your query out, or the next day. So be ready. Have finish your book first. This is, of course, for fiction. When it comes to nonfiction and book proposals, it's kind of a whole different world. I think we're focusing mainly on fiction here.
And in a subsequent episode, we can talk about the differences and how that process goes. One of the main goals that we had when we started this episode was to keep it shorter. And now we are already floating at the 39-minute mark. So I think that I just want to remind people that there is query letter review going on our website and on our YouTube channel. And if you want to have us look at your query letter live during a podcast and read it and talk about what works for us and what doesn't work for us, send it to info@collaborist.org. Otherwise, be sure to follow us and engage with us on the social medias. We're on the Instagram, we're on the LinkedIn, we're on the Twitter, and wherever you're listening to your podcasts, if you have time, rate and review this particular one. Jay, do you have anything to add to the close?
I've got one very quick story I wanted to throw in here. We were talking about the query letter that advertises that this is going to be the most groundbreaking idea ever. I was working as a technology journalist in the 1999-1998 zone, and there was some buzz that came out of Silicon Valley about this new technology, codenamed Ginger, that was going to completely transform society, and it was going to change the way that we create towns. It was going to change the way that we get around and build roads. And it turned out that that piece of technology was the Segway. So
I remember everything that you just said. I was receiving that information here in Madison, but I remember before they actually said what the Segway was, that there was this groundbreaking technology and it's going to radically transform how cities operated and people got around. And this is the future. Uh-huh. Yep. And now I see like security guards at the mall riding it. And I'm just like, yeah, that was the future. You know what? That's actually a good metaphor for the future we were promised and the future that was delivered. Like, it's, we're not quite to utopia yet. We're just trying to scrape our way out of dystopia.
Look at the mall security guards taking a little, we save them some exercise. And that's what we've been able to pull together so far.
Our best and brightest are on it.
It's a step all in right. the right direction. For story.
For a community. Collaborist. All right. I'll see you later, man.